And the other big bombshell that seemed to come out of this was the nuclear weapons being stored at Van Waters Base. When did that, because it was, I remember Larry, when he met with the NSA agents, that they were pretty, they didn't want him to even go there.
That's right.
But then,
you can talk about the UFO, but do not talk about the nuclear weapons treaty violation.
When did that come, at some point that must have come out in the process of writing the book, because by the end of the book it's sort of like, It's a fact, pretty much.
Yes.
So what's the story with how that came out into the public venue?
Well, it came out very specifically after, let's see, 87, 88, 89, 80, by 94. You know, we were 7 years into this, and it was only in 94 for the first time that a British UFO research group invited us to speak in Great Britain. Up until then, our trips had only been research trips. But in 94, we went over and we did a marathon presentation before several hundred people in Nottingham for a terrific grassroots organization there. And it was during that talk, spontaneously, without any planning, that Larry said, "Folks, I'm going to let in on something." And I felt myself go, "Oh, shit, what's up?" And he just laid the whole thing out. And to the best of my knowledge, it was the first time that anyone, anywhere, certainly in civilian life, speaking before a civilian audience, said that in 1980, Great Britain was lied to by the United States, who had committed a mega treaty violation by having a huge amount of nuclear weaponry in the United Kingdom without the permission or knowledge of the UK, or at least, you know, maybe they had tacit, quiet, secret, top secret approval on some high level, but as far as the treaties went, it wasn't until 82 when the Reagan-Thatcher love affair axis allowed for us to bring in limited ordnance, which was MX missiles, which were the ones that were flatbedded onto trains. The idea being that they could be moved into tunnels, you know, in time of national emergency, as opposed to, Christ, all these field nuclear tactical weapons that could be jeep launched and all this creepy stuff. And so Larry laid it all out there. And not long after that, we were ready to go back again. And that's when this totally Franz Kafka-esque story of Larry not just losing his passport, but the State Department's records of him temporarily disappeared off State Department computers.
Yep.
And that's when I took a deep breath, and at the suggestion of our then literary agent, who I'm sorry we weren't able or didn't stay with us, he said, "You need an attorney, and your criteria is, number one, you've got to find somebody that will at least take you seriously. Number two, somebody who has potential clout that he could actually do something about it. Number three, he's got to be somebody that will work pro bono, because you need somebody that you cannot afford." And my first question was, "Well, who do you suggest?" And he said, "You're the writer. Right now, Larry is totally preoccupied with this. He's freaked out about it, and appropriately so. You're going to have to deal with this. So basically, meditate on it and think of who you would like to be your lawyer and go after him." And as I recall, this was in the year of the OJ trial, and none of us were thinking very nice thoughts about attorneys.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, Christ, I do know who I want to go after. And it was former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who, bless his heart, worked with me directly in several meetings and took his time, which I'm sure was probably $500 an hour at least at the time, and gave it to us freely, met with me several times, then met with me and Larry, and helped us get that passport back in record time with an apology. And within weeks, we were back in England doing some mischief again. But the whole nuclear thing came up rather spontaneously in 94. And the State Department had ultimately said the reason for Larry's trouble, and it was on computer, and it was read off the screen to him by the person that he spoke to on that conversation when he called the state, was quote-unquote, "Your passport has, you know, is in the status that it's in for speaking out on sensitive defense issues in a public forum on foreign soil. And that's how that happened.
Wow. Okay, so let me see here. The book came out 8 years ago. What's your reflections on the book and the reaction to the book? Mm. You know, just in general, you know, the book comes out. It's been a long time since the book came out. The book's sort of taken on a life of its own, I guess, at this point. So what's that been like?
I'm very proud that we were able to complete it. As you know, it did go on to become a bestseller in the United Kingdom. It got wonderful reviews. It had the honor of being reviewed in the Ministry of Defense's in-house monthly magazine. It got a very good review. Members of the ministry were recommended to read the book. In October 1997, it was the subject of direct confrontation between a member of parliament, a former admiral of the fleet and chief of staff of the Ministry of Defense, Peter Hill Norton, recently deceased, who went up against the then Secretary for Defense on the floor of Parliament, referring to Lefted Eastgate by name and drawing questions directly from the book, which were posed to the Secretary, who evaded all the answers appropriately. I have two letters from Tony Blair's personal secretary confirming receipt of the book and stating that, as far as we're concerned, he has not read the book. And if he does, I don't think they're going to tell us. In the States, it was something of a disaster in that we found that we had gotten, through our very mediocre agent, a extremely unscrupulous publisher who bought the book ultimately for a tax loss. Can you imagine? They bought the book to write it off to lose money. And we flipped, and they said, what are you going to do, sue us? You know,
how did they do that?
Well, they absolutely broke our contract in a number of ways as far as promoting the book, as far as making good on distributing the book, as far as making good on translating the book. They lied to us about our royalties. And it was not for several years after that until I was able to get an attorney who's been working with us now for 4.5 years, and we are about to take their asses into court. And
oh, wow.
I hope we will have some peace of mind on that. So that was a very frustrating thing.
Now, let me just give you a side question here.
Yes.
You've touched a thought here. Do you think they at all were working at the behest of anyone else to sort of bury the book?
Mm. I didn't at first because it's not my nature. Larry did at first because it is his nature. At this point, I think it may well have been a very real possibility that they found out after the fact they bought a book that was not a flying saucer book, but potentially a very embarrassing book to aspects of the American government, that maybe they shouldn't do anything that they didn't, maybe they should do whatever they could to make the book a non-success. Where the book sold out of its first printing in the UK, our publisher there, who I really liked and I think did a very good job for small press to promote it, I think they were gotten to in so many words. The book never went into reprint. Up until last year, it was not available at all in the United Kingdom, even as an import. It was very weird. And it had took me some years to realize, maybe we really had stepped on some feet, and that I should grow up and realize that there were hands in this that I felt uncomfortable about, but it wasn't a fluke that the book was so difficult to get in the UK and that it had basically been destroyed here. And partly for that reason, and partly because we have the 25th anniversary coming up, Larry and I decided early this year that we did want to get the book back into print. The rights had reverted to us at that point.
Oh, that's good.
Yes, and I found a small press in New York here that was interested in reprinting it and more in reprinting an updated version of it. And I'm working with them right now to do just that, and that new version of the book should be available sometime in December here and in the UK in perpetuity.
Awesome. Well, this interview
will stay in print.
This interview will probably be running around November, so they'll be able to pick it up, and hopefully they'll be able to pre-order it or just plain old just.
Yeah. Well, the way it's going to work, it's part of a new trend in publishing called print on demand, where small presses, it's very hard to compete with the big guys. And
yeah.
For big presses, it's very prohibitive. You print, you know, a tremendous number of books by some super well-known author, you know, Bill Clinton's memoirs or Norman Mailer's new novel or whatever, and you often pay a huge advance and print huge numbers of books, and you're stuck with sometimes tens of thousands of copies that have to be remaindered or discounted, and you lose your shirt. Here, the book will be listed in perpetuity at Amazon.com UK and US, Borders, Barnes & Noble, etc. Any bookstore in the world can order it for you, but the way that we're able to compete is you won't see it in bookstores unless they really feel, gee, this thing is taking off on its own again and we want to have some in stock. The name of the company is Cosimo, C-O-S-I-M-O. And that's important because otherwise there are still remaindered copies that you can order online, say at Barnes & Noble, of the out-of-print version. But starting in December, you can get in touch with any book dealer in the world or any of the big websites and say, I'd like the copy of UFO of Left at Eastgate published by Cosimo. And again, because it's print on demand, it's not like it's limited run and then goes into reprints. It simply will be available hypothetically forever in both countries. Yeah, and there's printing facilities in both countries. So as things stand right now, besides doing what I can to promote it, I'm very glad that we'll be seeing it referred to again on the Sci-Fi Channel where Larry and I are interviewed and they show the book in December, as well as on the new History Channel documentary in December. There is a possibility, and I state just a possibility, because as of last year, NBC now owns the Sci-Fi Channel. I have a meeting next week with individuals at NBC concerning their showing the Sci-Fi documentary in December.
Oh, wow.
And this has totally not happened yet, but I'll simply say it here. It's possible.
Yeah.
I'm meeting with folks next week also at NBC with the possibility that the NBC News magazine Dateline do a feature on this in December as well.
Oh, awesome. So you expect a big media firestorm at least.
I expect something.
You hope.
Yes. I'm also going to be working as hard as I can to draw attention to this story in the 25th anniversary with other American media. I'm doing what I can to get myself back on, Art Bell and Coast to Coast and a number of other wonderful radio shows around the country, as well as television hookups, cable, and network. Also, I'll be spending, and as of this morning, it's definite because I just confirmed my ticket, I will be spending all of December in the UK again. And
that's fantastic.
Larry and I have right now about 6 different talks set up all over the country, and we'll both be back on location for the 25th anniversary in the woods there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really great.
Can you imagine? Jesus.
So, so I assume that you catch in touch with Larry. Has your relationship gotten better since you've both been sort of unshackled from the burden of making the book?
Yes, I'm very pleased to say yes. You go through that kind of shit with somebody and you either never want to see him again or what you are left with is a really remarkable friendship that's been through hell and high water. And we really do care about each other a lot. I'm very happy to report he's married, has a wonderful son who's, I guess close to 5 years old now. Larry has lived in England for the past 5 years. He comes to the States usually once a year to visit. He met, when we were doing our speaking tour in 97, he met an English woman that he ended up marrying,
and
she lives in Liverpool. So he has been a resident of Liverpool for about 5 years. And I just spoke with Sue earlier in the day, and I'll be spending some of December with them, some of it with our friends down in Suffolk, including Christmas. And as things stand now, I think we have confirmations for talks in Leeds, Birmingham, Manchester, Yorkshire, with several others pending right now, but we'll be doing our best to raise consciousness about this all over the UK in December, where you can bet it will once again spring into the news and onto television all over the place.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that we can use that to wake up Americans a bit more to it and get some interest back in gear here and give the book another life.
I think so. I think, I know a lot of people want to read the book, and it's so hard to get a hold of right now.
Yeah, I'll let you know, specifically when it's definitely back in print, but as things stand right now, it looks like ideally early December it will be available for anybody to order again.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really great, yeah. Because it took me about a year to get a hold of it, so.
Yeah.
And actually, ironically enough, you probably recognize this. When you go to one of these UFO conferences, there's tables with books.
Sure.
That, there must be just a group of people who go to all the conferences.
Yeah, that's true.
But they have just whatever UFO book you could ever ask for, which is pretty amazing.
It's a huge number of books.
And there was Left at East Gate.
Oh, cool.
First edition.
Ah.
Autographed.
I love it.
By you.
Oh, no.
I was psyched. Yeah, and I didn't even notice the autograph until I got home.
So cool.
I was leafing through it. I got home, I opened it up, and I was like, holy shit, this is autographed.
For years, I tried to always have stickers with Larry's signature on it to give out to folks who had, you know, had only mine. And I'll try to have one in gear. I'm completely out of them now, but I'm having to do some more soon, and we'll certainly get one for you.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. I'm really pleased that you were able to find it, for sure, especially after the wonderful way that we got to meet.
Yeah, I was psyched.
Yeah. Terrific.
That pretty much does it for Left at East Gate questions.
Yeah.
This is a long thing. The only other lighthearted question I had was women and ufology. It's a terrible mix.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very good question.
Can you give some advice to a young ufologist who would like to find a young woman?
Yeah, I would say don't get into ufology to meet women.
I've noticed that.
As you know from hanging out at the conferences, it's mostly guys.
Yeah.
And occasionally, you know, there are women there, and I think, as in all things, you know, when you're looking for, right, exactly, people are people wherever you go, and, you know, you find romance in the strangest places sometimes and new friends, but I'm amazed at, you know, the cross-section of the population this subject brings in. But the percentage of women is certainly less than men historically. I've met some wonderful women over the years who do have an interest in this, but at least as often as not, the women that I meet that I've been involved with really don't have much of an interest in it, or do after the fact because, it usually changes when you meet somebody, one person in a subject that, you know, up until that point you've never really given any thought to, or if you have, it's not particularly serious thought. I remember in 2002 I spoke at a UFO conference. It was the National MUFON conference again, and it was in upstate New York in Rochester. And there was a representative from a Turkish UFO organization there who was speaking there. And she's become a good friend of mine over the years, but her name is Esen, E-S-E-N, Sekerkara, which is not a name you've ever heard before, but not terribly unusual in Turkey. And she was the talk of the conference. She was extremely smart and very well spoken and knew her subject terrific, but she, frankly, was one of the most stunningly beautiful women that most of us had ever met. Just an extraordinary natural beauty, and not affected, and very down to earth, and very accessible. But there were like packs of guys spending the weekend just sort of drooling in the corners. And, you know, oh my God, it just, we couldn't stop, you know, just making all these silly, nervous guy jokes about this is what we've all dreamt about for years. And gee whiz, again, beauty is skin deep on a certain level, but wow, when it's there, it's extraordinary. But she's a total sweetheart and just reminded all of us eligible guys there that you know, so many different types of women do take this subject seriously all over the world. Last November, I had the great honor, privilege, and really amazing enjoyment of being one of the first non-Japanese to lecture on our subject for a national UFO organization in Japan. And it was just one of the most enjoyable UFO-related experiences of my life. I was there for a week. I delivered two papers at a national conference. I had met one person, their main translator, at that MUFON conference in 2002. And she had first contacted me in 2000. She had actually read Left at Eastgate and said that Japanese were not only interested in this, but reminded me that Larry had visited Japan in 1984. It was his first real UFO venture out of America. And for them, they take not just the subject seriously, but interestingly, the Rendlesham Forest incident, they consider certainly one of the seminal UFO interest cases of all time.
Oh, wow.
And they asked our permission to begin to publish parts of Left at Eastgate in Japanese. And I spoke with Larry about it. We both agreed instantly that not only would we be delighted for them to do this, but that we would not charge them anything in the interests of, you know, increasing international understanding.
Yes.
And also in the hope of beginning to build up a following in Japan and get this into Japanese. So they have now been serializing the book for like 5 years on a quarterly basis.
Oh, wow.
In the Japan UFO Report Japan, which is a wonderful publication in Japanese. And so by the time I got there last year, I really had a following. And they were kind, lovely, wonderful people who some of them will be friends for the rest of my life, and I look forward to my next trip over. And that, you know, and that the reason I kind of segued into this relative to women, where here in the States, it's usually men, you know, they're adolescents up to like middle-aged guys mostly. In Japan, it's very different. It's almost exactly 50% women, 50% men that are seriously interested in this. And they, the range, the age range and socioeconomic range is much more interesting. They range from teenagers to people who are retired and well into their 70s with extremely high percentages of professionals, professors, attorneys, medical professionals, doctors, et cetera. So I was very impressed with them, with their organization, with how seriously they take the subject. They're very special folks, and I met some lovely women there who, you know, were very knowledgeable on the subject, but, you know, via Japanese publications and conferences, this is a worldwide phenomena, and there's a worldwide following.
Nice. When are you going back? I'd love to take a trip with you.
Well, the greatest honor for me, I knew going over, working for a Japanese-American company, a certain amount about etiquette and, you know, behavior, and I had some basic Japanese also. My late mother had been an executive with an Icon Corporation in America and had traveled in Japan and had many Japanese friends, was interested in Japanese culture. So I used all that for all it was worth, and I knew from my mom that, and from my business friends, that Japanese do not take, you know, American or foreign visitors home to meet their families. If you're there for business, even if they like you and it's cordial, you know, you meet in restaurants, hotels, conference centers, whatever. And I was brought home and kind of adopted by my host family and their two wonderful kids. And they made it clear as I was leaving, and we were all close to tears. It was very emotional, that they did hope to bring me over again in a couple of years, and God knows it's expensive. You know, to bring me over for a week, fly me over, give me a nice honorarium, feed me, put me up, tour me around the area for several days, it cost them thousands.
Oh, wow.
And it's a little organization. They saved for years to bring me over.
Oh, wow.
But they would like to bring me over again. Again, it may be some years, but they said, next time you come over, though, you stay with us. And I thought to myself, this is the ultimate compliment. So I am very flattered by this. And for what it is worth, when you have your website at a point where you would be, you know, like to make contact with these folks, I will be glad to put you in touch with their main translator and speaking person and invite them. You know, I think one of the things that they really appreciate my doing is I've sort of kind of cut a path and made introductions to significant American and British researchers, including Nick Pope and Tim Good and Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs and things, and encourage them to give the Japanese permission to translate selected articles and papers. And, you know, for you to say, you know, you have my permission and my best wishes if you would like to create a link to my site from yours or to translate any of these interviews that I post, they do appreciate that, and that could initiate a relationship that ultimately will develop a body of friends and colleagues over there for you that you can visit at some point in the future. And it's one of the wonderful things about traveling. I love to travel, and I fell in love with it when I was in my early 20s at a time when Americans could travel more freely to places than we can now, and really wasn't much more than a kid with a pack on my back, but I was on the road a lot and traveled in places you wouldn't believe, including several trips to Iran, several trips to Pakistan. I've traveled all over Afghanistan. I've been up to the Tibetan border just about, in Nepal. I've been all over India and Russia and some of the weirder corners of the world. And it's one of the things I really love, where the work itself, again, I don't love as much as I'm obsessed with it. I do love people often, and I love traveling. And so for me, the biggest perks on the job have been some of the people I've met over the, almost three decades. Some of these wonderful places I've been able to visit that I might not have ever had a chance to visit if I didn't know one person, you know, and just get that hook and swing over and develop more people. And England has become a second home, almost needless to say, over the past 18 years, and I'll always go back there, and I'm very proud of the fact that I have friends all over the country, and, you know, they are always welcome here, and in many cases, I am often welcome there, and that's good stuff. That's good stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like you've traveled quite a bit, too. I remember in the book you detail the trip to Nice.
Was great, too. Oh, my God, to get paid to go to the Riviera and talk about UFOs.
I know, it must have been quite a trip.
It was great.
So from your experience in Japan, do you think the stigma, there's less of a stigma?
Much less.
Really?
Much less. In fact, Jun Kato, who is the very dynamic director of the Organization of UFO Research Japan, his day job is he's a very respected advertising executive.
Wow.
But he's extremely dynamic. He's a good writer, terrific speaker. I don't have to understand Japanese to know that he's a wonderful speaker. I've heard him speak. He has done, a great deal of Japanese television and radio appearances, and he's published articles all over Japan in a lot of straight major newspapers and magazines, and not just, you know, quote-unquote UFO publications. Also, I have a theory on this, and I may be completely off base, but because Japan, in a certain way, is more open to the impossible, the insane, the absolutely unthinkable reality of having been the subject of having two nuclear bombs dropped on it.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the things that made the Japanese such pioneers in science fiction filmmaking. We joke about most Japanese science fiction films, the goofy, you know, Godzilla spin-offs from the 50s. But the fact is, the Japanese are very open-minded on these things. And UFOs? Sure. Why not? They even have, there are probably several hundred political parties probably are in the States too, mostly small ones. But for, gosh, I think at least two decades, there has been a UFO political party.
Oh, wow.
That has campaigned on trying to, you know, the central issue is truth about UFOs. This is not a joke there. And people that are into the wink, wink, nudge, nudge reality of it are at least numbered or maybe outnumbered by the folks that are open-minded enough to say, yeah, maybe, why not? I'm interested. I take it seriously. I was so interested to learn when I visited there the percentage of people in my audience who were distinguished university professors, were doctors, respected attorneys, highly successful business people, was truly phenomenal. And through my translator, of course, the questions that I got over the time that I was there, and we did a big skywatch together as well, were extremely well thought out and articulate. There is a streak of the Japanese character that is somewhat mystical, and that is, I think, understandable, rooted in the Shinto tradition that they are. But they're also very pragmatic and straight-thinking, and they're a perfect example of a country where you don't have to, you know, act like a silly, nervous jerk and make fun or, just wonder what to say or whether the person is crazy or not. Yeah, this could be true, too. I want to know more about it. Yep.
Sounds
so that's very
place.
Healthy, very healthy like that, I thought.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's very encouraging.
I agree. If only we'd learn the lesson, but it ain't going to happen with these very scary people leading us.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, did you get an indication of probably one of the more mysterious countries as far as ufology goes? That would be the Chinese ufology, because they're so close, the doors are so close. Did you get, since Japan's so close to China, geographically wise, cultural somewhat, did you get any indication of what's going on in China with ufology?
Well, I did, and it didn't come from the Japanese. It's been a pet subject of mine for years, and when I first got into this in the later 70s, of course, who knew what the hell was going on over there? We now know that they were having the same basic ratio of sightings, near as we can put together, as we were. It's a worldwide phenomenon. No reason that wouldn't be the case. But the most interesting thing has happened over the last few years as their very unique brand of communism has been slowly melting down into this weird socialist capitalist hybrid, that even when it was more rigidified, there were UFO research organizations around the country, but they were not open to lay people. You had to have at least an engineering degree to qualify. And in these more quasi-liberal times, the last half dozen years or so, these organizations have now proliferated all over China.
Wow.
But that basic rule is still in place, which is doubly interesting. It's not like MUFON, where if you're interested in UFOs, you send them $50 and you're a member and you get the journal. You have to establish yourself as somebody with a credible professional background, preferably in engineering. And they are very analytical about it. They are completely non-mystical. For them, it is nuts and bolts and the possibility of beings from other planets. But it is now wide open, and there are many Chinese UFO journals. Even now, most of us here, even if we're interested in it, have not a lot of access to it. But it's something, if you have a colleague or a friend or somebody who is fluent in Cantonese or Mandarin or one of the basic dialects, and who is fairly facile online, there are quite a number of Chinese UFO organizations represented by serious websites all over the country. Now, again, we don't hear about this, but there it's now, no stigma. You're interested in UFOs, you qualify and you can join a good UFO organization and you will compare notes with your colleagues and study and learn what you can. So doubly intriguing and, again, totally unique, not like any place else, especially with this focus on wanting members who are technologically backgrounded and not just interested folks.
Yeah, So it's very interesting, yeah.
It is. And as China acquires more power and clout in the world, as they are continuing to do, I think this will probably become even looser and better organized and, you know, more prevalent throughout Chinese society. I can't say it for a fact, but my sense is that they also do not have our typical Western reaction of, oh, you know, little green men, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah.
They are extremely motivated people who value education and knowledge tremendously. And it just makes good sense that they would be interested in an anomalous topic like this. Who wouldn't be? And an open or semi-open or opening society if the government is not going to get in your way or, you know, get silly on your head about it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for going so long. If you,
oh, that's okay, Tim. Glad to do it. You ask intelligent, perceptive questions, and I've been looking forward to doing this with you.
Awesome. Okay. Just to touch on probably the last topic here tonight, that would be, I read one of your, you sent me some articles and stuff that you'd written, and I knew previously that you had worked with UFOcity.com.
Yes.
And you said you'd been in the field for probably about 30 years, right? Is that what you said?
Close on. I think my interest really started to explode in the mid-70s, yeah, pretty much.
So, obviously, you were in ufology way before the Internet came along. So,
yeah.
What was your perception of the Internet when it first came along with regards to ufology, and how do you think you've seen the Internet evolve as a tool for research in ufology,
yeah,
and also as a hindrance to research?
Well, first I have to say I'm very much an analog thinker. I'm being dragged into the digital world where, you know, the difference between 10 or 15 years is tremendous at this point in, you know, human development. If you were exposed to computers in high school or elementary school or even university, you're in a very different place than people who are so-called adults, and, you know, then we get introduced to them. I was fascinated by it. It seemed impossible to me. It seemed like something out of Star Trek. I was not early online. I didn't even start to, when I started working on Left at Eastgate, believe it or not, in 1987, I never even considered that I'd be working on a word processor. I had an IBM Selectric typewriter. And within a year, of course, I realized, oh my God, you know, how do people write books on typewriters? This is amazing. You've got this thing called word processing. They've got something called cut and paste. It's like I used to really do with scissors and tape, you know, and, you know, no joke, and writing small and, you know, retyping and all this crap. But it wasn't until I began to work for a multimedia company in Midtown Manhattan here in 98, where my boss, the business had nothing to do with UFOs, but my two bosses had read Left at Eastgate, were very interested in the subject as private citizens, very convinced of a government cover-up of the topic, and brought me in to develop a part of their business that would deal in UFO-related information and getting it out on the net. And it was not a success in terms of creating a viable part of their company that would make them money, but the net result was that we established something called UFO City that I founded with their backing and their finance. Essentially, it was an information-related website where I took 20-plus years of goodwill in the research community and had stringer reporters and people helping me find new stories all over the world. And over the 5.5 years that UFO City ran, it closed down last year, I posted thousands of stories, and on a number of them I was the first one to break the story. I was very ethical, but a handful of times that I went to press with something and then found out that it was specious, unlike a lot of sites, I made a big point of going online again and correcting the story.
Yeah.
And, I was very proud of it. It took up a tremendous amount of time and energy, but I essentially was editor-in-chief of a five-day-a-week UFO newspaper information service, and you know, linked up with, gosh, hundreds of sites around the world related to the subject. As far as UFOs and the internet, when I first started to explore the internet, I was shocked that the largest concentration of websites were all pornographic.
Yeah.
And that is in fact true. Believe it or not, the second largest proliferation of early websites, and this is an informal demographic, but I think it's fairly accurate, was UFOs and the paranormal. I mean, they were not nearly as many as the porn sites, which never really interested me. I think pornography is kind of sad more often than not, and empty stuff for people that are, you know, just sexually frustrated and have poor social skills. But I was fascinated. You know, if you go online, for example, and you type in UFO, you come up with more than a million hits.
Oh, sure.
Of sites, and I'm amazed, you know, if you type in UFO and then you type in my name, how many unbelievable references come out now at this point in time.
Oh, yeah.
It actually was quite shocking to me when I realized that. But I saw the best and the worst. There's so much absolute, total, specious bullshit, and there are also so many decent people working so hard to put together quality information and get it out there to the rest of the world. It is the best and worst of us, you know, electronically translated in a way, out there in cyberspace. I'm fascinated by it at the same time as I mean, not nearly as much time on the internet chasing down stories and things now as I did when it was my business for 5.5 years.
Yeah.
I am a book person, and from the time I was very young, I was brought up to love reading and love books, and as I speak to you, I'm sitting in my library room here. I'm surrounded by walls of books. I don't know how big my library is, but I'm sure I have several thousand volumes, and I certainly have, I don't know how big it is compared to other people that collect books on UFOs and are involved in the field or are just, you know, committed bibliophiles with this as a specialty. But I have literally hundreds of volumes on UFOs and, I don't know, I'm sure several hundred pounds of reports and journals and, research papers and all that on the subject and encyclopedias, etc. And I always encourage people who are interested in this subject or just anybody in general that will listen to build your library. I love movies. It's great having a nice DVD library. My brother-in-law is the one in our family is building the real big one. I've got a little one. But for me, the world of books will never be displaced by the internet, no matter how much information there is. There is a tendency, and it's very easy to fall into, to do things in a half-assed way and not be able to fully back them up.
Yep.
Where a published book that has been researched and fact-checked and spell-checked and updated can often be much more valuable than alleged late-breaking news and developments from a so-called news and information service. I realize more and more that, the future is about electronically transmitted information, but I think it'll be a very sad day if humanity ever reaches a point where these wonderful paper and board rectangles disappear out of our world. They're wonderful things. I think of them as dear friends, and, many of them, I'm looking at spines and remembering stories in the books as well as when I got the book or who I was with when I got the book.
Yeah, they all have a story of their own.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the internet is, of course, very important. Its place in UFO studies cannot be understated. And at the same time, we're in a world where fewer and fewer people read. And unfortunately, we have a chief executive who sets the worst example of any president in history, as far as I'm concerned. He doesn't read.
Yeah.
But the fact is, at whatever point in our lives that you say to yourself, well, I've learned everything I can, you have actually stopped breathing, or you might as well.
Yeah.
We should all be students of the things that fascinate us for as long as we're conscious. It also, I think, keeps you ageless on a certain level. You know, your body ages, but as long as your mind is agile and, you know, you're in the swim with people you share interests with, you know, life is rich and adventures are right around the corner, and you never know what's going to happen next or who you're going to meet next. And it does keep it very exciting. Also, the place of, like, where we met, UFO conferences.
Yeah.
I don't care, you know, how many great documentaries you have in your DVD library, or, you know, how many cable channels you have that show UFO stories, or, you know, even how many books you read on it. There is, once again, no substitute for making contact with the real people. And a nice long weekend, emblematic of when we met at the X conference, where you can just hang with folks who are just getting involved or who dwarf you in their interest and, you know, knowledge of a certain subject. It just enriches your life. My next big one is beginning in November, the third annual Crash Retrieval Conference in Nevada. And I'm particularly flattered to be speaking there for the third year in a row. Uh-huh. Because, yeah, I think I'm the only speaker they've had that has never really spoken about crashes and retrievals. And Ryan and his dad, Bob Wood, wonderful researchers and interesting men who organized the conference, have flattered me tremendously by basically saying, yeah, even though you're not on topic, you know, your subjects are interesting and you do good papers, and come on back. So I'll be speaking yet once again on non-crash and retrieval subject, and one that is sort of an idiot child of ufology. It has to do with, I think, certainly one of the most brilliant scientists in history and one of the most misunderstood, whose work took him directly into UFO studies, and who almost nobody in ufology is aware of, and if they are, it's in a very distorted way. And his name was Dr. Wilhelm Reich.
And, oh, wow.
He was Freud's first assistant in part of the 1920s, broke away, and pioneered a science about how energy functions. And it took him into human neuroses, cancer formation, political behavior, weather systems, and weather modification, and ultimately ufology. And he was extraordinarily courageous and very insighted, and so I'm going to be delivering a paper on his work in the area, and that's a particular interest of mine. Studied him on and off for many years, and I'm honored to have an opportunity to present a paper on his work at such a good conference.
That's great.
Yeah.
And just bringing it all back home here from discussion of the internet, one of the good things about it is situations like this where we can bring actual interviews to people. You know, they don't have to dial up the radio. And
it's totally cool. And not only am I excited about it, and that there are folks out there doing it like you are, but because of your particularly good questions, and you've become a very good interviewer, Tim.
Oh, thank you.
I want, once you post this, please send me the URL so I can do an emailing to folks out there on my mailing list.
Oh, I definitely
and
will.
Give them an opportunity to hear what I think is probably definitely an outstanding interview that I'm always going to be proud to know is on the record as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, and I think everyone's going to love it. And,
hey, Tim, my pleasure.
And one more time, let them know the book's coming out in December. Right? Reissued will be in December, and hopefully by the time they're listening to this, they can either pre-order it, or they'll know to order it, or it'll all be on, and they can get it. And they definitely should, because it's by far one of the best UFO books I've read in a very long time.
Thanks, pal.
And it's a human drama. It's a UFO story.
Yeah.
It sort of pulls the curtain back behind what really happens for someone who goes through the experience and then takes the experience all the way to the book form.
Yeah.
And what happens to his buddy who he pulled in to write the book, which is you. And then, you know, who expects that to happen to them, that whole thing? And
I sure didn't.
It's a great book, so I hope everyone listening, if they haven't read it already, I'm sure they're going to want to after this discussion, because there's going to be their sleepy peak anyway, and I think it'll make a great supplement to the book, too, for anyone who already has read it.
Thanks, Tim.
So thank you so much for the interview, and that should probably do it.
You're most welcome, and I'll look forward to keeping in touch.
There you have it, folks. That was Peter Robbins. Big, huge thanks to Peter Robbins for appearing on Banal of America Audio Season 1. I think, really, this was one of the best interviews we had in the series so far, and I was just really happy with it, and I hope you all were, too, and I hope you really enjoyed it, and I hope you come back for more great interviews that we have coming down the line. Big thanks to Leslie and Chiron of BanalofAmerica.com for your continued support and help with the audio series. I also want to give a shout-out and big thanks to two particular websites that have been instrumental in helping us get the word out on Banal of America Audio Season 1. First of all, The Anomalist. And you can find them under www.anomalist.com, anomalist.com, and The Daily Grail. And you can find them under dailygrail.com, dailygrail.com. They've both been extremely helpful in getting the word out on Banal of America Audio every week, posting some information about it and linking us up. So a lot of people have found us through those websites, and I want to give a thanks to them for their help. And thank you to everyone who's been listening to Banal of America Audio. I want to also remind you that we have a very special bonus edition of Banal of America Audio available at banalofamerica.com. This week we posted it on November 1st. It is a hour and 20-something minute discussion with Webster Tarpley on the Scooter Libby indictment, war with Iran, synthetic terror, terror drills used as cover for synthetic terror, and that's available as I speak at banalofamerica.com. And, of course, next week, November 12th, 2005, we will have as our very special guest Grant Cameron, one of the most respected minds in ufology. He's been tracking the UFO presidential connection for quite some time. He's a native Canadian who's done just a wealth of research and has amazing opinions on a host of topics. That's going to be another two-part interview for Banal of America Audio Season 1 next week, the first half of that interview where we discuss Grant's introduction into the world of ufology and some of the key players in Canadian ufology over the years. And you'll be able to find that at banalofamerica.com on November 12th, 2005. And in case you didn't get the address yet, it's www.banalofamerica.com. I hope you check it out and dig into what banalofamerica.com has to offer. And so, until you hear from me again, this is Tim Banal saying so long, everybody.